Hello and welcome to the Mega Game Assembly podcast. My name is Harrison and I'd like to thank you for downloading this month's episode. We've got a corker for you here. This is an interview with Alex Beck off of Horizon Mega Games. As part of his work at Horizon Mega Games, Alex has designed and run three of his own games, and we think that each one has maybe moved slightly more towards an accessible and new player friendly genre and theme. And we spoke to him about his thought process and his design process for his three games and how that's changed and been modified over time. We think it's a really interesting conversation to have towards getting some new people into Mega Games, which is what we're all about on this season of the podcast. So without further ado, sit back and enjoy. Okay, we now have the honor of being joined by Alex Beck of Horizon Mega Games. How are you doing this evening, Alex?
Hello, not too bad, thank you.
For anyone who's listening and may not be familiar with you and your body of work or your history of Mega Gaming, do you want to give us a brief bio of who you are and how you've ended up here?
Sure. So I guess I have two hats in Mega Games. I guess one I'm probably most known for is I run Horizon Mega Games, which is a Mega Game group based primarily in London. We very much focus on kind of genre games, so sci-fi, fantasy, and kind of horror games primarily. We've run around about a dozen games now. The plan was to have about 20 done by the end of 2020, but obviously that has obviously not happened. But you know, hopefully pick that up next year. That's kind of one half of what I do. I guess the other half is I'm a designer as well, so I've designed three mega games, which things. A lot of what we're going to talk about today, Crisis and Elysium, which is kind of a Martian Revolution game, Mirror Shades, which is a cyberpunk mega game, and Monsterville Mansion, which is more of a sort of horror Halloween kind of special mega game. So, kind of two different parts really that I sort of focus on.
Fantastic, cool. Do you want to give us a brief overview of either all three or just Crisis, and then we'll go through one at a time?
Maybe for I'll cover all three, so I think there's probably little bits where they cross over. So the first game I did was Crisis and Elysium, which, must be getting on 3 years old now. It's a game of Martian Revolution. It's obviously a sci-fi game, and it's kind of set in the sort of after 100 or so years of Martian colonization, and then sort of classic sci-fi revolution scenario, and there's lots of different groups battling both to sort of keep it as part of Earth control, and also to battle sort of their own vision for the future of an independent Mars. I guess it has a more military theme than some. I've sort of run it myself several times in this country, both with Horizon and with other groups. It's also been run in Sweden and looked at a couple other places around the world as well, so it's been run quite a few times now. My second game was Mirror Shades, which I believe was the first cyberpunk mega game. I don't think anyone had done one before that. That being the case, I sort of took all the classic cyberpunk tropes, threw them all together. So it's kind of the punks battling the evil corporations, you know, on the streets of a mega city. They're all sort of drenched in 80s neon and synthwave and all that kind of stuff. I've run that a couple of times in London. It's been run other places around Europe and the world. And then my most recent game was Monsterville Mansion, which was kind of designed very much as a sort of Halloween special for Halloween last year. Really just took loads of kind of classic horror movie tropes and kind of, you know, monsters, vampires, werewolves, wraiths, you know, swamp monsters, so on. And kind of just put them together in a kind of classic haunted house kind of scenario, really. That has so far only been run the one time, but may come out again in a future Halloween. We'll have to wait and see.
I really hope Monsterville Mansion comes back because it has been, to date, my favourite mega game.
Oh, well, thank you. I think it needs a little bit of tightening up in parts, but I definitely intend to go back to it one day, so it will be back.
good. Looking at those three designs, how did the thing that inspired you change? Because they've, as you've said, they've all got quite different themes. Crisis and Elysium, a bit more militaristic, a bit more kind of drawing from the classic mega gaming tropes in a way. Mirror Shades stepping in a slightly new direction of really taking from more a genre than a conflict, and then Monsterville Mansion kind of going even more in that direction. That's just from my perspective. What's driven that change for you?
It's a big question, so I'll try not to to ramble too much, but I think at the heart of all of it is that I'm basically just a bit of a tart for pop culture, particularly kind of nerdy sci-fi, you know, fantasy horror kind of pop culture. And so I've really, each in turn has just been something I like, and it has ideas and tropes and concepts that I thought would make something fun. I could see there being a game and you know, excuse to dress up and role play and all the sort of fun stuff that the mega games provide. So I think that's probably what is at the heart of it. But I think each one, as you say, there's definite trajectory in the way they're going. And I think each one had their own little kind of story as well.
Okay, cool. Well, do you want to run us through the story for each one of them?
Sure. So I think obviously Christ and Elysium is, as you say, the most traditional one. And yeah, it's a military game. There's maps. There's a military hierarchy, a political hierarchy, all that kind of stuff. I think definitely is found in a lot of older mega games, I suppose. So I think, but it wasn't necessarily I went out to make that kind of game. Just that I had an idea that fit that kind of structure, so it probably seemed easier for the first game. So I think if I'd come up with the idea for Monsterville Mansion, I think that might have been a struggle because I wouldn't have known how to make that into a mega game. But I had the idea for Crisis and Elysium, and it easily fit into the mega game structure. So originally, before it became a mega game, I was actually playing with the idea as a board game. I could never quite get it to work because you needed more players, or the rules became way too complicated, or whatever it might be. And it just never really worked as a board game design. But as soon as I kind of got into mega games, it seemed like a perfect fit, both the theme fitting what was expected of a mega game, but also that being a mega game with the number of players and the extra sort of complexity that they provide could do all the things that I couldn't get done in a board game. So I think that's kind of how it was, sort of almost it was from both sides. It was both something I wanted to do and something that fit the mega game structure really neatly and really obviously. And it was taking ideas. You know, the Martian Revolution is a pretty common trope in sci-fi. I personally love the Three Colors Mars books by Kim Stanley Robinson. I mean, there's The Expanse out there now, which I know a lot of people love, and there's loads of other books and movies that have played with the idea. It was just sort of something I love. Had this idea for a game, and it just perfectly fit the traditional mega game structure, I guess.
Well, having played in it, I can say it's a very good game, and I highly recommend it.
Thank you. Well, I appreciate that.
I kind of feel like I had to say something after Matty's glowing recommendation.
No, I like, you know, please keep coming with the compliments. Great.
Oh, no, that's it. You get one from each of us, and that's it for the evening, I'm afraid. I think it's interesting that you said you were trying to design it before you got into mega games, and you were trying to turn it into a board game, and then you discovered mega games, and then you realized. So how long were you playing with the idea before you ended up turning it into a mega game?
Probably a couple of years. I've sort of been into gaming, board gaming forever really. The last kind of couple of years before Chups and Sit Down did the, you know, Watch the Skies and everyone got into mega games. I've been sort of playing around with some board game designs, done a few things, did some play tests with friends and stuff, but never really got anywhere more serious than that. And the sort of Christ and Elysium concept was one of those that I was playing with, and I hadn't done tons of work on it or anything, but I'd played with various ideas and had a design document, and then the kind of Shut Up and Sit Down turned up, everyone started playing mega games, and the rest is history, I suppose.
Okay, cool. So moving on to Mirror Shades, what was your origin story for that one?
Cool. So I think I've done Elysium, gone down well, run it a couple of times, and I guess I had a certain confidence then, both as a designer and probably as an understanding of what mega games could be. There are other, you know, a lot of new people obviously had joined the mega game scene in that period. Loads of ideas were being thrown around, people were trying slightly different things, new ideas were there, and I think that point you raised earlier, Matthew, that it was, I think, maybe some of the traditional shackles maybe began to come off a little bit, and I think, you know, you can probably overplay that a bit because I know different people have done weird things and stuff over the years, but I think certainly when I first got into mega games, things have become perhaps a bit more traditional in their structures. And so as new ideas started coming back in, or sort of, you know, maybe ideas were reintroduced to mega games, you could begin to open up what it could be and what a mega could be about and what the gameplay could be like. So it was a less organic process than Lyssium, whereas, you know, kind of it was a much more deliberate intent of, right, what am I going to design for my second game? Had a number of concepts, kind of played around with maybe doing some sort of fantasy, sort of done D&D type inspired game. I played with a kind of idea of sort of a fantasy, sort of, yeah, supernatural high school, not too dissimilar to what Becky eventually ended up doing with her Trope High, sort of similar themes to that, which again, yeah, it's another classic white fiction theme. But ultimately, you know, I love cyberpunk. As far as I was aware, and still I don't think anyone had done a cyberpunk game. I was like, right, this is ripe for the picking. This is a genre no one had done before. A lot of people love this genre. You know, it could work really well as a mega game.
Amazing, cool. So was it in the back of your mind that you thought maybe it was an untapped market out there for people who wanted to play cyberpunk mega games, or did you start wanting to do cyberpunk and then realize that you might be able to market it to players who wouldn't go to traditional historical wargaming type mega games?
I think it was my love of cyberpunk was the starting point, and then thinking about it and the fact there hadn't been a cyberpunk mega game then made me think, yes, maybe there isn't a new audience for this kind of stuff. This is the kind of thing a different kind of player might be attracted to. So, you know, it was probably the two thoughts were quite wrapped up. It was something I wanted to do, but also the reason I chose that rather than, say, doing another sci-fi military game, which is, you know, something I still enjoy, was because I felt, yeah, it could bring new people in, definitely.
Fantastic. Cool. Okay, and so finally, Monsterville Mansion. What was your spark for that one?
It was a similar process to Mirror Shades, but also I also just really love Halloween. So, you know, can I keep going back to this? I think ultimately it's probably quite, I don't know if selfish is the right word, but I think as a designer, you have to do something you really love and enjoy. You're going to be working on this project for hundreds of hours. And if you're purely doing it because you think it's a good idea but don't really like the subject, I think that'll be a real struggle for you, and that would come out in the game. So I think it's got to be something you love. But definitely, I was like, I love Halloween. I love sort of cheesy horror movies. I think that could make a great game. But also, yes, this is, again, like with Mirror Shades, that is a audience that could easily be brought in that haven't played mega games before. People love dressing up for Halloween, going to Halloween parties. You know, people could definitely come to this who hadn't come to a game before, you know, dressing up as a werewolf or a vampire or whatever. So I think, yeah, it was again, a dual process, something I love, but supporting an audience that hadn't maybe had a chance to play the sort of game they wanted to play before.
No, I think that's great. I think that's, like you say, I think designing something you love is very important, especially the hours involved in creating and crafting a game and so forth. So I think that's definitely the important first step. But I do think it's, I think I probably say it every podcast, but it's what I love about mega games. It's such a universal thing. It can work for absolutely anything, any style of game, any genre, you know, any, almost any size of game, any type of game. It's so flexible. And we here are very, very enthusiastic about the new wave of designs that are out there and coming through. An exciting time to be a mega gamer.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think there's loads of ideas, and sometimes I have vague ideas back in my mind and someone else comes out and does another game that does what I want. I mean, you know, Becky and Trope High is a really good example. Other people have done other things. I'm like, that would make a really good game. But, you know, they're getting there and doing it, and it's like often, it's always, I'd imagine, better than what I would have done. So it's really exciting to see other people doing the kind of games that I want to play. You know, I don't feel like, you know, it has to be me that does every game that I want to play. Other people do the same as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Because you can't really play in the ones you write, because if you're running them, so it's nice if other people put them on.
No, exactly. Definitely. So, you know, there's a lot of book left, so all my games I'd like to play them, because that's why I kind of design them, but you never can, really. So it's a shame. But, but yeah, I think, you know, back to the point you made about it being something you love, I think that's really important. And for me, it's always been having those really core themes that are just really kind of classic tropes, you know, to the point of just stereotypes, and having them in those games. You know, Mirror Shades is filled with every kind of 80s cyberpunk trope you can imagine. I've just pulled out every single one, every little cliche, thrown it in there. You know, the names are all inspired by books and movies and TV shows and video games, and very much the same Monsterville Mansion. You know, they're just ideas pulled straight from movies like Cabin in the Woods, of every other kind of sort of modern horror movie that kind of plays with those tropes, just taking those tropes and throwing them all in a game, really.
Yeah, I think your knowledge and love of the genre really came through, particularly in Mirror Shades. That game was just dripping with theme and details and setting, to the point as well where I think that was the first mega game I went to that had a Spotify playlist that went with the game, which I thought was a really, really nice touch that you did there. And I would encourage other designers to do that, which I think you played on the speakers while we were playing the game. If memory serves, yeah, which I thought was a really nice touch.
Yeah, for the first one, we didn't have the gear for the second one, but it's something I've sort of tried to do for a number of our games since then. It's kind of put together a soundtrack playlist kind of thing. You know, I wouldn't say it gets thousands of plays or anything, but I think certainly it's a little crowd of players who appreciate it, kind of gets them into the right frame of mind.
Yeah, I find it really, really useful.
It definitely adds to the sort of setting as well. And just on the day, I can't actually remember if you had one for Monsterville Mansion because
I did have one, but it wasn't, the speakers weren't super loud, so it was only, you could only really hear it if you were right by the speakers, which is a bit disappointing. So yeah, but there was one. They're all stuff on Spotify if anyone wants to have a listen. So yeah,
I do still listen to the Mirror Shades one. It's one of my working playlists. I find it really good for focusing for some reason.
Excellent. That's it, sort of shit. But, you know, I just think it's, soundtracks are so important. You know, movies and TVs, you know, soundtracks are just so intrinsic to the experience of watching that film or whatever. And, you know, a mega game should have that as well. You know, it's something a lot of people do when they're playing, you know, tabletop role-playing games, D&D or whatever. And I think it's something that's really important for mega games where we can do it as well.
Yeah, I think it was a really nice touch.
Cool. Excellent.
Are there other ways that you think, you know, maybe you haven't been able to for these games so far, but that you'd like to add in terms of adding to the theme through set dressing or props or anything like that? Is that an area that you'd like to go into?
Definitely. I mean, it's something dabbled in a very small level for Mirror Shades and Monsterville Mansion. You know, we had a few sort of little, you know, for Mirror Shades, there was some kind of neon glow sticks and stuff dotted around, and some, you know, sort of cyberpunky sunglasses that people could wear. And for Monsterville, we had some Halloween decorations dotted around. The real difficulty in doing that has been the venues, and therefore, you know, it's generally a big, fairly characterless hall that you're hiring for these events. And so to really properly set dress and to really kind of evoke an experience is incredibly expensive. You know, you need a lot of material, a lot of skills probably in that kind of area. At the moment, I think it's probably a bit beyond most mega game budgets. But yeah, I mean, if we could do that, that would be great. You know, that for a Monsterville type game, you walk in and it's a proper, you know, haunted house style setting would be amazing.
Cobwebs everywhere.
Yeah. Skulls sitting there. All the stuff Harrison doesn't like.
Whatever floats your boat.
I remember the human table for that game was covered in Halloween treats, obviously, because it was around Halloween. And so just even whatever was on the table was, you know, pumpkin chocolates and, you know, skull candy and all this kind of stuff. And it just, for Monsterville Mansion, it just happened without you even trying.
Yeah. There's definitely some themes that are easier to kind of pull forth, I think, and everyone's going to buy into than others.
In terms of design, one of the things that I've got the sense of from the progression of your games is also making rules sort of simpler and making them a lot more approachable, just in terms of rules complexity as well as theme, and making them sort of accessible. Has that been a conscious decision on your part?
Yes, definitely. To make them simpler and easier to understand, I think, you know, I think that's often the biggest challenge for mega games is being able to, people got to pick the big game up quite quickly, usually with and they're only probably going to play it the one time, so it's not like a board game where you can play it once and then be like, oh, we didn't quite get it right, let's play it again, it'll be okay. You know, it's, you've got to get it. So I think you definitely want rules that are easy to understand. I think I also like complicated games, you know, personal taste. I think it lets you do interesting things. So I think I'm always looking for that sweet spot between something that's really interesting and engaging and fun to pick up and easy to pick up. And you can just go with it and it's simple and smooth, but also has enough systems and mechanics that allow interesting things to happen. Because if you get a game that's too simple, it turns into, I don't know, noughts and crosses, too complicated and everyone's playing a game of Warhammer 40,000 and no one wants either of those extremes. So it's finding that sweet spot. So ideally it would be a set of instructions that are just super easy to pick up. You read them in 10 minutes and you get them all, but create really interesting gameplay scenarios and gameplay decisions. That would be the holy grail. and I think some of that's about the rules itself, and some of it's about the way they're presented, and I know it's something Jim Wallman, obviously game makers and grandfather of the scene, has worked on a lot in recent years about getting the rules on the components, about not having many rules in the handbook beforehand, it just being all visible before when you turn up on the day. And I think there's a lot to be said about that. Make the learning process part of playing the game rather than something you have to sit down and do beforehand.
I think, as well as being the first mega game I played with the soundtrack, I'm pretty sure yours were the first games I played where you had produced video guides for like sample turns and certain elements of mechanics you're playing during the day. I think, again, video is a medium that is really underused in mega gaming. I personally, when I'm playing something with a particularly mechanical heavy role, I find watching someone do it, just penetrates my brain a lot better than reading a rule book. So I think that's another great way that you have of getting people to be able to pick up stuff. Give them an option of being able to watch a video as well as reading a rule book.
Yeah, I mean, I think credit where credit's due on that one. It was actually when Johan from Gothenburg Mega Games ran Elysium for the first time, and he created a rules video, and that really made me think how good that was. I mean, the video itself is obviously in Swedish, so it was a limited use to me, but it looked great, and I think as you say, it helped some people get it. So yeah, we did it for Mirror Shades. I ran out of time of doing it with Monsterville, so I didn't get a chance to do it, which is a bit of a shame. And I think it's definitely something I want to try and do as much as possible if time and budgets and whatnot allow. So as you say, it's really helpful.
Yeah, I just think, like I say, for different people's brains work differently, and for me, being able to visually see what's going on seems to work better than just reading a rule book. So I think that's something that's really valuable.
Yeah, weirdly, I find rules videos are just utterly useless. I could just stare at them, and I need a book, and ideally the components are in front of me, and then I get it in 2 seconds. But it's just it's just the way my brain works.
Yeah, different strokes for different folks. I think that's
exactly. Yeah.
I am definitely a learning by doing person. I read rules with mechanics written on them, and most of the time it's sort of in one ear out of the other, and I sort of get a vague sense of what's going on, but really until I'm seeing it in person, it just doesn't really go anywhere.
Yeah, no, that's I'm the same. I need the components in front of me, then I get it. But it's it's right. Which I think kind of can lead on to that kind of discussion that I know has been had a few times about sort of first turn demo turns and that kind of thing, which I don't think anyone's entirely got quite right. I think sometimes a demo can just be really bland, and it's like watching a video and you're having to sit there and wait when you want to get on with the game. I think but then also I think other people find it useful. So I think there's a real space there about teaching maker games that I don't think we've quite hit the perfect way to do it yet. But there's certainly more to be done, I think.
Yeah, I agree. I think unfortunately there's probably not one way that works for everybody. So the solution is probably to do some sort of demo turn, do a video, maybe do an audio version, maybe do a written rule book. But that's a lot of commitment to do for every single rule and every single mechanic. So it's a difficult one to get the right answer to, I think.
You said you don't think we've reached quite as far as we can go in terms of making sort of demo things work. Do you think we've got as far as we can go in terms of trying out really simple rules? Because I think there's a, I think one of the things that I remember thinking when people were talking about, oh, let's try and simplify rules, was I worried that part of the magic of mega games comes from the complexity and from, you know, the million things going on, and that oversimplifying, we'd lose a little bit of that. I think since that, my perspective has definitely changed a little bit. I think there is definitely a space for simplifying, but still keeping what makes mega games, you know, really great. What's your take on that sort of whole, you know, the complexity and the balance and all of that?
I think you absolutely can keep simplifying stuff to the point where almost you have no rules and no mechanics, at least no mechanics, because there's rules of some sort. But I think it's at what point does it stop becoming a mega game and does it become a LARP or interactive theatre, I suppose. And I know we don't want to define mega games. That is a dangerous topic. But, you know, a really good example is some of the historical games, some of the sort of Congress conference games that they've run, the Washington Conference being probably the most famous one that's been run a few times in recent years, Dave Mowdy's game. That is essentially a mega game without rules. You have a role and your team, and you're representing a nation at the Washington Conference. And, you know, it's then just a game of pure negotiation and discussion. There are no rules, really. There are no mechanics. It's essentially, these are the facts of the time. See what you can get for your country. And then you just sort of spend the day talking and working through that. However, I've famously said a few times in public, I don't believe that's a mega game. For me, that's a LARP. You're playing a character in a role-playing game. For me, that isn't a mega game. You do need the mechanics, and that kind of element of the game for me is what defines the kind of some of the mega game experience. So I guess to answer your question, Matt, yeah, I think you can have as minimal rules as possible, but at what point does it stop really having the mega game experience? I don't know. It's probably quite a gray area, and there's, you know, it's entirely down to personal choice, I think.
One of my favorite questions to ask people is why they think Den of Wolves has become such a popular mega game. I think you can make a fairly safe case to say that it's probably the most played mega game out there. You know, obviously Watch the Skies has that title, but I think you could probably make a case that it's Den of Wolves is probably going to be overtaking that relatively soon. And I think for me, what I like about Den of Wolves is it has a certain amount of simplicity to it. Like you say, you have the rules, because obviously you've got like mechanical rules and all that kind of stuff, but there isn't really all that much there. And what there is relatively simple and kind of universal. The way the ship production works is basically the same thing, regardless of what you're pumping out the other side. It doesn't take very long to learn. And I think there's enough rules there to guide it, but it basically gets out your way. And I think that's the sweet spot for me with rules and mega games and that kind of thing. I think there needs to be something there, but it needs to kind of not get in the way of the emerging story, which is what we all play mega games for, I think.
Yeah, I think I'd completely agree with that. And I think the magic in mega game design is knowing when there's enough mechanics and rules to support the story, and also when is there enough story and theme that the players will run with that themselves. I've talked about Den of Wolves a few times on podcasts. I probably have gone about ages, but it's a real sort of, there's an X factor to that game where the if even for people who don't know Battlestar Galactica, the theme and the setting and the way the paranoia is set up, that players just pretty much always run with it. They just go with what they want to do. You know, they kind of get into the theme, they get into the role playing. And I think as a designer, that's so hard to know whether you've got that bit right. So often you maybe stuff more mechanics in just to give players thing to do. But you're right, Harrison. If there's too much of that, they actually get in the way. If the theme and the role playing part is working, it's just a really tough balancing act, I think.
Yeah, I agree.
I actually think it's a balance that you struck just right in the human side of Monsterville Mansion, which is what I was playing. The theme came out so strongly, and there wasn't a ton of mechanics for the human players, but the story and the engagement and the role play just kind of fed itself. And then, you know, you've got everyone being a 20-something-year-old college person going through a haunted house, and it didn't need much. So I think it's something that, yeah, Monsterville Mansion for me did really, really well. It got out the way of players just creating their own narrative.
Yeah, and I think for me that was really instructive as a designer, because you two have been very complimentary, so I'll slack myself off a little bit here. And, you know, I think you're right, mate. It worked really well for Human Game. I think I designed the monster game in a very different way. It was very mechanics heavy. And I kind of thought the idea of being a vampire or a ghost or a cultist or whatever, people would have run with that. So I didn't put so much story into it. It was all quite sort of vague. It was generic. And I think what happened was, because there were more mechanics, a lot of the monster players got mired in that, didn't really see the opportunities to run with the theme, weren't sure how to act as a cultist or a witch or whatever, and got stuck really too deeply in the mechanics, while, as you say, the Human Game, where, you know, I was really fearful that there wasn't really enough to do, it was much easier to get into those characters and run with them and play with the theme, while the monsters struggled a little bit. So yeah, it was kind of, I think it was really informative to me to sort of see that, right, you need to make sure you've got that story structure, and some things are more universal. So yeah, as you say, probably everyone playing a mega game has been 20 years old. Most have probably been at some sort of college. So kind of got that idea. And, you know, people have certainly seen the movies and TV shows and stuff. So they've got that. While the idea of a vampire is actually quite undefined and nebulous. Is it a Twilight vampire, a Buffy vampire, a classic Dracula vampire? You know, you actually probably needed more details as to what vampires were, what did they want to do, what were their relationships, what were their goals, kind of thing. And that could have meant I could have had less, you know, mechanics about dealing with their minions and their resources and all those sort of things. So it was really informative for me, and that's why I want to run the game again, but I also know it needs quite a bit of work to kind of go back and reform that whole half of the game.
I think this is an interesting thing. What really worked about the human side was that the mechanics were very light, but they were very narrative encouraging mechanics. To give a few examples for people who weren't at the game, so one of the mechanics that the humans had was relationship cards. So you had a couple of best friend cards and a relationship cards, and, you know, I'd exchanged a card with somebody, and then, you know, you started helping each other out on your respective goals for the day. So I really wanted to find what was it I wanted to find? I wanted to find something.
You were a jock, weren't you? So were you looking for the team mascots that got taken away, something like that? I think, yeah.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah, I wanted to find the team mascots, and I ended up being best friends with the stoner in my sorority fraternity, and so they wanted to find weed. And so, you know, you're going through various decks on the map, you find weed, and I'm like, bro, I found weed, you know, and all this kind of stuff that just like encourages interaction and encourages a real sense of camaraderie between the human players, which, you know, for me was really awesome to see. My sense of the monster game was that it was still fairly mechanics light, but they were mechanics that, like you say, tied people to the map. And so they sort of were less like prompts for interaction, whereas the human side was just, the mechanics were full of prompts for interaction.
Yeah. I mean, I totally 100% agree. I think that the monster game is more focused on managing resources and controlling the map, which are, I guess, quite dry concepts. And they had themes, so if you were a vampire and you took over a room, you could turn it into a vampire masquerade ball or whatever. But they were quite light, and it was the driver for them was more that gave them a room with some extra resources, kind of thing. So I think they became really focused on that. Well, as you say, the human game, I can't even remember if you got anything for finding the things you're looking at. I think you got a very minor bonus in, you know, kind of resources and thing. But it was more about the theme. It was, yeah, I found this thing I wanted, rather than you know, here's something really useful. So yeah, I think that's really insightful, kind of why the problem was there. Really, the monster game is too focused on resources and map control, not enough on actually telling a story about Halloween.
But if we tie that back to why I think one of the reasons why Den of Wolves works so well is that, again, a lot of the mechanics are prompting interaction. So the mechanics are, you know, you're prompting, you need to find resources, you need to find XYZ. And I think direction for design. I think light mechanics that really prompt and encourage interaction is definitely, for me, the way to go. I think that's really been in my designing attempts, my sort of direction and philosophy. And I think something that Monster of a Mansion did really well in the human game.
I completely agree. I think that is a really fertile, for me, word, kind of area of design that mega games can go into. It's kind of really trying to encourage that narrative, the role playing, the theme. And I think it has the added bonus of actually being possible. I mean, I don't want to sound this like condescending or anything like that, because it's really not meant for that. But it's almost a little bit easier for the designer, I think, trying to make balance mega game economy with loads of resources and complicated mechanics is really, really, really hard. And I think that's kind of what happened with me in Monsterville. I became so obsessed with getting the complicated resource economy and mechanics for the monsters right that it became too big. It became this monster, you know, ironically became a monster out of control. And I think if you more focus on the narrative elements and the story and what allows for a good story to happen and interesting interactions to happen, that isn't as, you know, you don't need to have massive spreadsheets or anything. You just need to think more as, I guess, almost like more like a writer than as a mathematician, I suppose, something like that. But I think there's definite scope for that being a really good way for design to go.
Although, having said that, there are people out there who really, really love complicated economic rules and really complicated map rules that they enjoy, you know, really getting stuck into and things like that. So I think what it is, in a way, is that mega games to date have looked a lot at those very, very complex games, whereas these kind of lighter, more narrative games are something that we're experimenting with and I think are really rich ground for experimentation. But, you know, one of the things that we've got is variety and just increasing that variety.
Yeah, definitely. Because I think, you know, if you want to run a complicated military sim with, you know, worried about logistics and, you know, complicated combat mechanics, there's dozens out there you can get from different designers. And some people love that stuff. And, you know, some people love written reports all day. You know, they have tons of fun doing that. But I think you're right, to increase the kind of audience, variety, you know, more thematic narrative games is a good way to go.
And I think, as I said, the great thing about this hobby is that it can support both extremes and everything in the middle as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So one of the good things that I think has come out of the whole COVID lockdown situation is the rise of online mega games. Talking about having a space that will support all sorts of different things. Do you have any plans to dabble with online? Are you looking at any elements for those for any of your games? I feel like online sections for Mirror Shades would feel very thematically appropriate, but I don't know if that's necessarily something that you've thought about or looked at.
So I'm not going to do it for any of my games. I've kind of, certainly none of the ones I've done to date, I think they're all very component heavy. As you'll know, Mirror Shades has so many different cards, lots of maps and stuff. So I think the amount of work to really convert that into something online just terrifies me, to be honest. So I'm not going to do that. But as obviously this is now going on longer than maybe a lot of us hoped in the first instance, I'm starting to look at running some online games with Horizon, talking to a couple of designers at the moment about doing some stuff, throwing around some ideas myself as well. I think what I'm interested in it actually is that not necessarily completely about replicating the mega game experience as it exists in a hall online, because I think you'll never quite get it quite right, you know, no matter how much sort of Roll20 or Discord or, you know, kind of clever stuff you use, I think it's quite hard to get it quite right. So I think it's looking at what does online let us do that kind of adds to the mega game experience and then maybe drop some of the other bits, kind of thing. So I don't know if that makes any sense at all, but
It does. And in fact, my follow-up question was going to be, what do you think online adds to the mega game experience that physical cannot do?
Okay, cool. So I think, so the two big things that I'm really thinking about is, one, I think you can spend 8 hours in a hall talking to people. I think trying to do that online all day, people find really, really difficult. I mean, it's a lot of us having to do that for work, and it's, you know, you take every opportunity to walk away from the screen. So I think it's about shorter time frames, but mechanics and things like that can be kind of hard-coded more, maybe. So you can, there's something we want to shy away from in most, you know, real games is kind of complicated spreadsheets with loads of numbers, because, you know, that's a nightmare trying to run them in an actual game. But when you're online, you know, you can just have people tell me a number and you whack it into your spreadsheet and it's just sitting in Google Docs or whatever, or, you know, whatever you use. And you can use some of that computing power, I guess, that's at your disposal to do stuff. So, you know, and then I think the flexibility of the pandemic, or more people at home more often, you can perhaps start looking at more kind of persistent things. So games that run over a period of time, so a number of sessions run over a number of weeks rather than just a one-off event. I think the whole situation lets you do slightly different things that maybe move away from the mega game experience, but certainly use the same ideas. That's kind of thing, well, where I'm thinking at the moment.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. I did think it was interesting that some of the online games that have been running in America were run over multiple days as opposed to one solid chunk of time. And yeah, I'd never thought about the fact that 8 hours sat in front of a computer somehow feels more draining than 8 hours spent in a community hall talking to other people. So I think that's an interesting idea to then take that and really spread it over long term.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's a whole new thing. No one's really done it before. I think it's either been video games or you do stuff in person. So I think it's an interesting, you know, area to play with. And, you know, hopefully as and when things get better next year, it'll be interesting to see if any of these ideas continue. I hope they do. I think maybe it's a space for gaming that we can play with along with more traditional, you know, mega games in a room.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I say, I think we can definitely look at it as a positive thing to come into the hobby, and whether it continues that you have online games and physical games, or you have sort of hybrid games that contain elements of both, I think it's going to be really interesting to see what creativity the community comes up with and what gets thrown against the wall and what sticks, sort of thing.
Yeah, definitely.
There's a thing that I've heard a few times people say, which is, you know, people design the games you want to play, and I definitely see that as being like a really good way of getting just different people designing games, because different people designing will then produce different games. I find it interesting looking at the way you've designed games, because they're so, so different, which makes me want to ask, what is it that you enjoy about a game?
Well, for me, there's not many areas of kind of, you know, nerdy pop culture I don't like. You know, I like sci-fi, fantasy, superheroes, horror. You know, I like all those things. So any of those kind of themes interest me straight up. You know, and I don't necessarily prefer one to the other. You know, I enjoy Star Wars as much as Dungeons & Dragons, as much as, you know, the next X-Men or whatever. So I say, for me, all those themes are interesting. I want to play all those themes. And then when it comes to games, I just love games. I play all sorts of games, role-playing games, board games, video games, you know, mega games. It's just any kind of game I enjoy playing. So again, I am interested in a really complicated military sim game that takes 8 hours, you know, to resolve one battle, whilst I'm also interested in a card game you play after six beers in the pub, you know, that has two rules. So I just love nerd themes and I love games. And so just the two thrown together is that's it. So, yeah. I'm not picky as long as it includes those things. So I don't know if that answered your question at all. Probably not. But
it's interesting because it's, I mean, in some ways it's utterly unhelpful because you're like, well, I love all themes. Well, not all themes, but, yeah, you know, a strong theme that's nerdy and, you know, I like all range of complexities.
I think because there's always interesting game mechanics for me from, you know, a really complicated military sim will have some interesting mechanics in there that I can look at. And even if it's just, you know, I find the history of game design really fascinating. I read books about that. So it's kind of like, oh, that's using a really kind of, you know, Avalon Hill inspired 1960s combat resolution chart. You know, that's in itself an interesting thing to see that someone's still doing something like that. Or if it's a really modern new card game with kind of really swift, easy to use mechanics, that's great. That's something I can possibly steal and use for my game, you know. So yeah, I find them all interesting and useful to experience.
So referencing something you said at the very beginning, excuse me if I'm paraphrasing here, but it seemed to be essentially you were saying that you wouldn't have had the ability to kind of design Monsterville Mansion without lessons you learned designing your first two games. Is that accurate to what you said?
Yeah, so I think every game is a hugely educational experience. Yeah, definitely.
Are there any particular bits in Monsterville Mansion that you feel were heavily influenced by lessons learnt from other games?
Yeah, though weirdly, I think Monsterville probably turned out to be the most educational of the games I've run. I mean, for the next batch. But I think some of it was just sort of actually the process of designing. You know, what's the best way to design a set of cards, or you know, how should I organise my work? What's the priorities? You know, how do you write a handbook? Those kind of things. So I think some of it's just experience in doing the process. More from sort of related to that was that obviously, you know, we've talked about already. Mirror Shades has got literally thousands and thousands of cards in it, and it took forever to make. So even though I wanted to make another game that had lots of components like that, it was kind of like, how can I do that without that amount of work? So that's what I ended up doing stickers, because they're a lot quicker to easier to make. They're much quicker to print. You'd have to cut things out and stuff like that. So that was kind of a real direct lesson. How do I have the same elements that cards provide that I had in Mirror Shades, but it doesn't take so long? So I know it's use stickers, and that then creates an interesting mechanic in itself of where you can put stickers on top of stickers on top of stickers, which, you know, and do things like that. So yeah, and then I think there were just probably lots of little things about sort of layout and structure and just, you know, similar kind of rules and action resolution things you could use. Yeah, so I think it's just a whole experience. You know, you learn certain techniques and ideas and sort of throw them all together.
Would you say that some of that was from, you know, doing things differently to compared to how you've done it before, you know, like making mistakes, thinking that didn't work, how can I change it?
Yeah, definitely. And I think this probably point can't be made strong enough. I'm a massively, massively lazy person. and so a lot of my decisions were right, how can I get to the same result with less effort? You know, how can make this a process more efficient? You know, how can it be done simpler? The actual sort of design process, the testing process, and so on.
Cool. I think one day we need to sit down and have a whole episode dedicated to stickers versus cards versus counters. you're definitely going to be one of the guests for that conversation, because I feel like you have strong opinions on that one.
I do.
Having acted as control for you on Mirror Shades 2 and having to organise those cards, I also have some strong feelings on them.
I look forward to it. That'll be good.
Both Mirror Shades and Monsterville Mansion feel to me like they are some of the games that have brought in the most creative costuming. I mean, I've not been to Mirror Shades, but people have shown me pictures and everyone's wearing kind of neon and people have got spiky hair and there's kind of like Hawaiian shirts and ridiculous sunglasses, all this kind of stuff. And then, you know, Monsterville Mansion, I mean, you know, people are dressed as vampires. Someone came in a ghillie suit. My favorite thing from Monsterville Mansion was the chosen human team all came as the Scooby-Doo squad. Just amazing.
Yeah, it was so good.
Yeah. Is the potential for costuming an intentional thing in your theme choice, or is it just a strong theme leads to good costuming and vice versa?
For Mirror Shades, I think it was definitely the latter. It was just, you know, I love cyberpunk, and then it made me think, oh, a lot of people can really dress up for this one. This could be fun. It was definitely part of the Halloween theme for me, though. So yeah, it was one of the reasons I chose kind of Halloween and stuff for Monsterville. It was like, I knew people would dress up. I really wanted that, because I thought it could attract people who just wanted to have a fun Halloween kind of Saturday, you know. So yeah, definitely it was part of that.
I have definitely learned from the couple of games where I've really gone all in on costuming. I've had a great time because I found it super helpful in terms of getting more into character and like letting a bit more roleplay come out. So it is now definitely something I look at in a mega game, like, oh, can I make a good costume for that? So I think, yeah, definitely an audience there's an audience that is excited by costuming opportunities.
Definitely, yeah, definitely. Which is weird, because I hardly ever dress up myself, but it's something I do love people doing, and I really, really appreciate it as a designer when people turn up in costume. It's always a nice little thing.
I think it adds to the immersion, and as we were speaking about earlier, it's a way of helping other people get into it as well. If someone is in a costume and you're surrounded by people in costumes, it helps you be immersed in the theme, I think. That's a nice cheap way for designers to dress a room, get everyone to turn up in their own costumes.
It really does help, actually. Yeah, it's totally true.
Can I ask a controversial question?
Go for it. No, please do. They're my favourite.
So we were talking earlier a little bit about, you know, simplifying rules and going towards a more narrative focus and things like that. And there's a potential there for mega games to go in a more LARPy direction. Now, we're not going to get into, you know, where exactly that crossover point is. But I think I would say that there's a really big design space between where mega games are now and where most LARPs are, and that I think mega games could definitely go in that direction while still staying mega games. Do you think that's a potentially good move for the hobby or for some games to take? Or do you think that's, you know, it's essentially as a design space, do you think that's an interesting or good direction for the hobby to go in?
Yeah, I do, absolutely. I really do. I do think mega games are at the heart or a narrative and a role-playing kind of experience. They're lighter on the role-playing than a LARP probably is, but obviously more so than a board game. So I think there is, you're right, there's this huge space, and I think we're probably more generally at the board game end. So I think there's definitely a gap still between us and LARPs. How you do that without becoming a LARP, you know, does it matter if you have? I don't know, but I think there's definitely an advantage to heading that way, because I think there's going to be a whole player base who are probably interested in that. Either people who currently LARP who want to kind of try out mega games, or just, you know, people who maybe sit in the middle and is just interested in both. So yeah, I think it's a space that could be played in. I think a lot of my games have had, certainly the later two, have had quite characters with names who, you know, have sort of, you know, individual personal objectives. I think that kind of having a real role to get into with a history and a background definitely starts heading in that direction. But you're right, I think there's a lot further you could probably go and more you could do. But yeah, I think it's interesting.
So once all of this craziness is over and we're back to running games, what do you have in your schedule of the future for whenever that may be?
Yeah, so hopefully this spring, maybe summer, we shall see. The first two that will be off the blocks, which are kind of the first two, the last two we had planned for before pandemic, is Ben Hirsch's Starship and Six Shooters, which is kind of a Firefly Star Wars mashup. He's a designer, it's his first mega game, so I think that could be really interesting. And then I'll be running Mirror Shades again, actually, which obviously we've been talking about today. So hopefully, you know, that's a game that I'm hoping, you know, people have liked the sound of. I think it's quite good for new players. So yeah, keep an eye on the Horizon Mega Games social media, Facebook and Twitter and whatnot. And yeah, once we have a date that we can safely run games, we will get them going.
Fantastic. Yes, if you're in the UK and you are into your cyberpunk and that kind of thing, I can highly, highly recommend Mirror Shades. And as Alex said, I think it would make a good first mega game. So that would definitely get my recommendation.
Great to see lots of new players there. Always exciting.
Okay, great. Well, thank you very much for taking the time to chat with us. If people want to reach out to you about anything that you've spoken about, what's the best way for them to get in touch with you?
So our social media is probably the best. So just search for Horizon Mega Games on Twitter or Facebook. And we also got a website, horizonmegagames.com.
Okay, brilliant. Thank you very much.
Cool. No, thank you. That was great.
My thanks once again to Alex for joining us for that chat. I hope you found something interesting in there. If you want to find details of the Horizon Mega Games Facebook group and page, look in the show notes for this episode or on our website, megagameassembly.com. You'll also find links there to our previous episodes, as well as our calendars and blogs about all things mega games, as well as some free games and examples of games you can download to look at running yourself. So thank you very much for downloading, and until next month, thank you and goodbye.